Welcome back, listeners, to week two of our final five episodes here at Feel and Film. I'm Patch, one of your co-hosts, and with me throwing 90-mile-an-hour thoughts is my best friend and co-host, Aaron.
They will probably be just as wild as Rick Ron's pitches.
Just don't hit me in the head. No pepper, okay? No pepper. All right.
No, I'll be so wild that it won't come anywhere near your body. That's okay. How I do it. Yeah.
All right. Will that be ball four, ball eight, or ball 12? Which one will that be? I don't know. This week, we head to the baseball diamond. Since it's officially baseball season with our college teams already winning handsomely and our pro teams returning to the field, Aaron's holding up a number one, which does not equate to what his team is ranked currently. I think you're two and minus three.
Give me like 5 hours because Wake Forest just lost a series to Duke and you guys lost to Xavier. So
we lost one game. One, we won the series. Okay, let's just not.
Yes, but we lost no games and we will be number one, almost guaranteed.
Okay,
as it should be.
All right. Well, hopefully the national championship will come at some point.
Okay. Listen. Look.
I'm just a
championship this week. Did you? No, you got in a fight. That's right. Your team got in a fight and got ejected. That is what your team did.
We won the round is what we won. We won the round. We lost the fight, but we won the round. Okay. Well, let's...
Back to baseball.
Back to baseball. There's fighting there too, right? As we find out. We're talking the 1989 comedy Major League and hope you enjoy the discussion as much as we do. This is your official spoiler warning. It's on HBO Max as we're recording this, so please go see it if you haven't or rewatch it as we have done. It's a lot of fun, and if you listen to this conversation without watching it, it's kind of stupid to even pay attention. So anyway, all right. This movie, Aaron, centers around the Cleveland Indians. So I just want to take a moment of silence to mourn the loss of that beloved team. And in my opinion, one of the coolest looking like logos, the Wahoo. And I get it. Cultural appropriation, everything. I'm halfway on board with that. I don't want to get into any of that. But I think that the Cleveland Guardians just doesn't roll quite off the tongue as well as the Cleveland Indians. I think everything about this movie, really, if you put it with the updated team, it just wouldn't work, you know, because it's just, there's a lot of stuff in here that leans into that. But I just want to say, let's just pay respect to the loss of a great mascot.
Yeah. So my very first note when I was taking notes for the movie was, who are the Cleveland Indians? I've never heard of this team before. And I agree with you for the same reason. Like, it was actually a little bit jarring to me to see the Indians. Now, I quickly adapted to that because obviously we grew up with the Indians, as did most old folks. But I was thinking about how 20 years from now, kids who are just now, like, say, Tyler's age, my son is 19, and didn't really pay attention to baseball in his young years or whatever, but maybe kids that have been born in the last 10 years or so, 20 years from now, 15 years from now, this is going to be weird to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not going to make sense. And I agree with you. I don't want to get into the debate of like, should they, shouldn't they? But I did find this to be a little bit cringy, thinking of it in terms of like what we look at as cultural appropriation in this day and age. So we've kind mm-hmm. of shifted. I mean, there are things like, I wrote down some of the lines and I'm going to quote them because I was like, wow. So Bob Uecker says most of them. First of all, they have a promotion going that is free admission to anyone. This was just funny. Free admission to anyone who was alive last time the Indians won a pennant, which was like 35 years before.
Die Hard Night. I love that. Yeah, that's a great promotion.
Okay. But then the jokes that were made, you have Bob Uecker calling them the Wigwammers mm-hmm. at one point.
Yeah.
Anytime they hit a home run, he almost always says, that ball has gone off the reservation. And I'm just like, ooh. Yeah. And you've got these like dedicated group of like white fans all dressed up as Indians with mm-hmm. as Native Americans with their bogo or their drums and their like different like headdresses on. Yeah. And then even when they are winning at the end of the film, I don't care. You guys can hear my dog if it barks. I don't care. That's Ellie, and I can't control her. She's a maniac. Anyway, there's a newspaper headline, and it says Indian scalp socks. There is no mm-hmm. way in 2024 yeah. that would be a headline. So by that like regard, it was definitely a time capsule.
Yeah. And I think that in the age that we are in right now, there's still pushback because you've got the Florida State Seminoles who have an arrangement with the Seminole Nation to use their NIL. It's like NIL before NIL existed, right, for college. But my beloved Atlanta Braves have not taken that step. And I don't know because you're attached to brands. You're attached to moments. And so when I think about the Braves winning the World Series recently, I can't think about the team formerly known as the Braves, now known as the Hammer and Hanks or the Hammers or something like that. I understand. And there's definitely tone deafness that would not fly today. Like even some of these rewatches that I've been doing, I'm like, yeah, that wouldn't work. Yeah, that wouldn't work. Like we think about even something as recent as Mean Girls, the musical. I was surprised that actually got updated because when we watched Mean Girls for the podcast, there was a lot there. I was like, wow, that's even a little sensitive 5 years ago or 6 years ago. Like, how could they do that? Like the SNL kind of comedy. And so I look at a movie like this and I think if it were remade today or if you were centering around another team, first of all, to your point, kids that won't know who the Cleveland Indians are, this would turn into a movie like The Replacements in the sense that you're having to make up every team and it would feel like you're in a video game that's not licensed. So you, instead of playing the Dallas Cowboys, you're playing the Texas something like the Who Hammers or something like that. Just some kind of, or the, you have a vague resemblance of a cowboy. It's not the cowboy logo. It's a silhouette of a cowboy, but they don't ever say cowboy. And I feel like Major League will turn into this, but it'll be kind of confusing because you still got the Yankees, who are the rival in this movie. And that's never going to go away. Like, I don't think you'll ever get New York to make a change based off of someone or an entity like, hey, we don't like being called Yanks anymore. That's offensive or whatever. That's never going to happen. So it will be a little bit confusing. But I think the magic of Major League is not necessarily in the name, although I like it. I even like the fact that it's centered around a city like Cleveland. I don't know that this would work in like Atlanta or Boston or Texas because those franchises haven't historically been bad. And at the time this movie released, I know that the director and writer who's actually behind, I think, I don't know what else he wrote. He wrote a couple other things like he got an Oscar nomination for The Sting. He was a writer for The Sting. And he had really wanted to make this sort of a love letter to his beloved Indians. He loved the Indians and wanted to do a movie where they would actually win a championship of some kind. So I thought that was kind of cool. And I think that idea can exist. But I think with Major League Baseball and sports in general, finding more parity, you won't find these kinds of stories existing much anymore because you don't have the Cubs, the lovable losers. They've won a championship. You have, you know, the White Sox or Boston in that. And so I think this is sort of the time capsule, like you said, for those reasons as well.
Yeah, I think to that point, one of the things that I really appreciate this about this is that I would say you're right, mostly. I do think it's going to be harder to find this kind of story because of the parody in most sports and just because of the way professional sports have changed over the years and become much less about loyalty, much more about the money. You know, that not necessarily right nor wrong. That's a whole podcast discussion on its own. And it's really all a matter of preference of what you think. But there was more loyalty in the past, period, before free agency existed. And then once it did start to exist, there was loyalty. And that kind of bleeds into, like, your feelings about a team. Growing up with a group of – you got to experience this a lot as a Braves fan. You've had several runs of a decade or more, or at least a decade, where it's just, like, this core group of studs – yeah. Stayed there, and that's fun. But the thing I thought about when watching this was how neat it is that they don't win anything, Patrick. They win the division. This is not about winning a championship. It's not about – I actually True. Couldn't help but think about my poor Mariners. And I was like, this is what it's like. I celebrate the playoffs just like they celebrate in this stupid – I was like laughing at them for celebrating, and then I immediately had this like wave hit me, and I was like, oh my gosh. This is my life. This is the only thing I've ever had to celebrate is being in the playoffs. Like, we made it into the playoffs. We didn't do anything in there, and they may not have either. But the fact that the story is not about achieving the greatest goal, it's about achieving a goal within your sport. And I thought that that was really neat. And our buddy Paul at Cinematic Underdogs actually brought up that there's a couple other movies. Like, I think Angels in the Outfield ends up doing this same concept. And I just appreciate sports movies that buck the trend of feeling like you have to win it all to be, you know, successful in your sports life or in your career.
That's a good point. And I think that with baseball movies specifically, the worst to first approach, I think, is probably its most obvious here, more believable, because it happens over the course of like 162 games. You mentioned Angels in the Outfield. Same thing here. It wasn't about winning the championship, but it was about getting from last to first. So being in the cellar and overcoming that internal goal that they eventually find out about, that their owner wants to sell them because she wants the team to be that bad that they can sell the team and move them to Miami. And so that, I think, will exist consistently in sports movies, this idea of it's the underdog story, but more extreme, or taking that angle of, hey, we're a really bad team, but we have time to actually come back and accomplish the goal of doing something we didn't think we were able to. And just to give you a little bit of insight, Major League 2 sort of expands this. It's not as good of a movie by any stretch of the imagination, but they recap the fact that they, just like you said, they win that playoff, they win that one game playoff to get into the playoffs, and then they get swept in the first round. And so the beginning of like the whole crux of the second movie is about them getting to the second. I don't know if they win the World Series, but it's part of what makes that movie a little bit less interesting, because you're already good. So why? If the goal is the World Series, well, that's something that I think every fan of any team wants, is to get to the championship and win it. And that's not uncommon. Whereas not only the goal of going from worst to first to make the playoffs, which was not going to happen for them, that was like the pipe dream. Great. That's a great story. And then the way that they get there, specifically with Jake Taylor's bunting after calling his shot. I mean, I think that's poetic right there. The ability to do something unconventional. Like, I like the fact that he didn't hit a home run. I like the fact there was a home run at some point in that game, but that the winning run was about teamwork. It was about the strategic aspect of baseball that really just makes me happy. I love it that it's not just the long ball. I love a good home run, but it's like the dunk in basketball versus a great like step back three-pointer. That's cool to me, because that takes more finesse, or the no-look pass to a jumper or three-pointer. I will never look away from a dunk or even alley-oop, but the more people you can get involved in a play that leads to a score, to me, that's pretty awesome. And so I think this movie had both when it came to baseball. And so when we look at this, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to piggyback on that to say that I think for a sports movie, the baseball itself is not the most compelling part of this film. It's not the most entertaining action on the pitch. Goodness gracious, too many sports going right now.
New movie.
On the diamond is the word I was looking for in this sport. And I think that you're right. But it stays true to the team. There are sports movies where they are built around a guy who is going to be a power hitter and hit home runs. It would not make sense to me for Taylor to get up there out of nowhere and hit a home run. It makes sense for him to become the team leader and do the most imaginative, smart, intellectual baseball thing in that moment versus hitting the home run to win it. And I do think that is a critical part of what kind of elevates this movie too for me above what it could have been. It would have been much more boring if it was just two or three home runs back and forth to win it, win the lead, et cetera.
Yeah, I think when you look at a movie like this, the interesting thing that I took away from this viewing is that the more movies I enjoy watching and rewatching, the more I'm going to nitpick for just fun. Like, hey, that wouldn't make sense, but I don't care. So it's fun to nitpick. It's almost like, you know, criticizing your older brother. You can do that because he's your brother, but you're going to stand up he's going to stand up for you and you're going to stand up for him when it comes to like fighting other people. So I look at some of the things that don't make sense. Like this movie really centered around five position players and two pitchers. And I'm like, nobody else contributed to the montage of games that were won by this team over that 30 game stretch. I mean, that doesn't make sense. I also wonder, when you look at Ricky Vaughn, I remember at one point during one of my rewatches thinking, oh, he's a starting pitcher. I always thought he was a closer because he would come in.
Not till the very end of the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. But the fact is he's a starter. He's one of two that's effective though. And I think he only has two pitches. Like he talks. And again, this rewatch, I was like, oh yeah, forget about the curveball, Ricky. Throw him the heater. I'm like, oh yeah, he has a curveball, but he doesn't use it. And I'm thinking, how are you successful as a pitcher with two pitches, one of which is like awesome, and the other, which is not that great. It's not talked about. So I look at that and I'm like, this reminds me that this isn't really about the baseball. It's not about glorifying that like it is with Eight Men Out or even something like The Natural, where the game itself is a supporting actor. It's the ensemble cast. And I think that anyone who loves this movie will tell you the cast, these five, seven, six, seven core, maybe almost a 10, you know, 10 people in this movie, they drive it. And I think for me, one of my favorite sections of the movie is spring training. I absolutely love spring training because we get introduced.
It's a montage, basically.
It's a montage. We get introduced to all the characters, their types. And you start really picking out like, okay, who am I really going to latch onto in this movie? And every time I think I pick somebody different. This time around, it was the manager. I love, love, love the manager. He is so just like, you know, just like it's what you would picture like an old school manager. And I love how he gets roped in. Like he gets a phone call. He doesn't think it's a prank. He gets a phone call saying, hey, do you want to manage the Cleveland Indians? Like it's Lou Brown. That's his name. And he goes, hey, I got to call you back. I got a guy on the other line about some white walls. Like it's not even that important to him. Like this is how bad this team is. But I love that whole section because we get great comedy, but we also get to know some of these players on a team that we get to kind of fly through the rest of the movie to get to that one pivotal section of the last game against the Yankees. And it's really, really cool.
Yeah, I like the spring training a lot too. I think it's easily one of the best sections of the movie, just from them getting their calls to them showing up to Willie Mays Hayes getting carried out onto the lawn outside the baseball field by some guys in the middle of the night because he wasn't supposed to be there. And like you said, everybody, I think what's cool is that everybody on the team has some kind of an elite professional skill, but they don't all have multiple tools, as we would say in the baseball world. So like Serrano has incredible power and can mash fastballs anywhere, but he can't hit breaking stuff. Hayes, he's fast, but he can't hit. It's a great bit, especially at the beginning when he starts doing push-ups. I love that.
Yeah.
Vaughn has amazing speed for the time. It's funny, again, going back, because it was like 97 on the gun. And I'm like, dude, Arkansas's pitchers are touching 99 and like 100 sometimes in college. What is this? Is like, you know, it's athletes evolve. They get different or get better.
Yeah.
But like he has speed, but no location, right? And I thought it was cool how each player had these limitations to individually, they needed to like raise their floor so that their all of their ceilings together, you know, were good enough to compete. And they needed that because the movie could easily have, I actually remembered it, Patrick. I haven't seen it in like 20 plus years, probably since I was a kid. I remembered it much more like I thought of The Waterboy, where it was like, oh, they're all just a bunch of jokers and nobody actually has any talent. But that wasn't the case. And that spring training section did such a good job of telling us that, no, there's just a mixture of very, you know, there's some washed up veterans and all this stuff. Like it's like basically every season of the Oakland Athletics, but they have some talent. It just, you got to find a way to get it all together and to come out of them.
So I think about Moneyball when I watch this movie, and I think
that was the other one Paul mentioned actually.
Yeah. It's got some Moneyball elements, but I think it's kind of like pre Moneyball because they're trying to get someone with one tool to kind of fill in the gaps as opposed to finding the numbers. So it's less about numbers and more about specific ability, but it's still somewhat of a Moneyball approach because you're piecing a team together based off of specific requirements. Like, we need somebody to fill this power gap or this speed gap, or this, we need to find a pitcher that's going to be our blow them, you know, blow by them. And so, like you, I do think in some ways this would have had the flavor of something like The Waterboy, because everything just felt like a joke. I mean, this movie's so quoted, especially during baseball season. And Bob Uecker is probably one of the main reasons, like the just a bit outside, like that. I think I hear so much when I'm watching a baseball game and somebody throws a wild pitch. I mean, that's exactly what I hear. I hear in my head, just a bit outside. But in the middle of all that, or throughout the movie, and I think it's sort of elevated by the soundtrack and score, you've got this really nice balance of kind of laid back. It's not, it's really varied between the soundtrack and the score. Sometimes I like it and sometimes I don't, but I think for the most part it works because it really hits on, okay, this is a serious moment or one you need to pay attention to without kind of being overt, or this is comedic. Like during the spring training sequence, when you're finding out about kind of the goofiness of some of these characters and getting introduced to them, it's got kind of a little light rock and roll. And of course, when you get to the montage, it's like, great. But even the opening credits, the hello Big River, you know, it hits that somber tone of how bad Cleveland is, how it's just not the town that you want to feel like has a Major League Baseball club. And so I think the music in the movie really supports the balance of everything that we're getting in it that make it feel less like it's just a slapstick movie, like, I don't know, like The Naked Gun, and more, but not so serious, like Field of Dreams. It's like this balance of good comedy and some decent baseball here and there.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is much less of a straight comedy than I remembered it as well. It is definitely, it has sections that make it a sports movie with comedic parts. I know we'll talk about those in particular probably, but I think that it does just kind of, I don't know, epitomize the sports movie idea of having all of these tropes in one film, right? Like, you've got, like I said, players that have one elite skill, but something else that's not. You talked about like the down and out diehard fans of a place like Cleveland, a very blue collar location. And it just really captures all of the elements that we think of when we think about sports movies in general and puts them all in there. You got locker room shenanigans, and everything is sort of just like ratcheted up a notch, right? And there's some like realistic locker room stuff, and then there's some silly locker room stuff, which, you know, like playing a prank on Vaughn that he's going to get cut at spring training. Yeah. Like, that's a very normal movie thing. Like, that could really happen. You know, putting the outboard motor in a tub to form a whirlpool, like with an actual motor going between your legs. Like, that's not realistic, in my opinion. And I think that it does do a good job of like capturing all this, and teammates that have a shared goal, but don't necessarily all like each other. And they don't all come around to necessarily like each other in the end either. They find enough mutual respect to get by and do their jobs and focus together on the task at hand. And I really like that.
Yeah.
It's
not, you know, and I think that task at hand is something really important, because Roger Dorn just plays that to a T in the one moment where it's after Vaughn's, or his wife has told him about him and Ricky, and he comes up to him after he comes out to the mound, and he goes, I just got one thing to say to you. Strike this mother out.
Yep.
And then you see Ricky kind of grin a little bit, and he thinks it's over. He strikes him out because he wants him to get that thing out of his head. Like, he knows that Ricky knows, and he's like, get that out of your head, get this guy, and then I'll punch you afterwards. And I don't think that they necessarily are best friends, but I don't think they're necessarily enemies either.
Yeah, right.
And I think that they have, like, baseball is the common thing, and you celebrate the thing together. So I think that when you have even today in 2024, unless you have like the Marlins several years ago, who just basically bought their World Series as is said, and then sold off their entire like roster. I can't remember what year that was, but it was maybe 15 years ago.
I'd take it.
Most teams have at least three or four players that are part of that core team, and they'll bring in free agents and whatnot. And I think during a season of 162 games, you're going to have some camaraderie and you're going to have that common goal. And I don't think that's cheapened by the fact that you might be gone next year because of arbitration or because of free agency. I think there's genuineness in wanting to win a championship, not necessarily for the pride of a city. I mean, that's definitely something that's been lost, but the pride of a team. I mean, it happens with recreational soccer that I've experienced. I get new players every year, but that doesn't make them any less enthusiastic about winning games and being teammates and having other players that they can support, even though they may play baseball in the fall and not soccer. So I'm all for that. I'm there for that kind of celebratory stuff. I don't think that's lost. And I think that shows up here in this movie in a big way with this team.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that the unfortunate part of it is that they focus a little too much on a particular subplot and storyline that just doesn't work for me. I think to the extent of comedy that you get out of the, and I don't want to get the characters mixed up because when I see them, I see Dorn and Taylor, and for some reason they like shift in my head. Dorn and his wife, seeing him celebrating with a woman on TV and then going to get back at him by seducing Vaughn. Unbeknownst to Vaughn, this is a key part of this, is that Vaughn does not know who she is. This is not a willing thing that happens. That is a makes sense to me storyline within the context of this team that doesn't all get along for whatever reasons. But I really struggled with the whole Jake Taylor subplot. And I think what the film wants to do is give that old veteran they want to give most of the players, right, something to kind of overcome and something to a way to grow. And so for him, it's his wife. And we're never going to talk about it on this podcast, but Bull Durham has the same issue for me in the way that a relationship happens and is treated. This woman, Renee Russo, his ex-girlfriend, as far as I can tell by watching all of these scenes, which not only feel like they kill the momentum of the movie, a couple of them for me, one particular at the art gallery get together, it's so slow and just turns into like a they're just talking, and I'm just like, yo, can we get back to the baseball, please? And then there's another one when he goes into her house, but like, he essentially stalks her. He is aggressive to her in trying to get her to give him her number while knowing she's with this new guy who is her fiance right around the corner, and walks right into her house at one point, lies about reading Moby Dick, which is the only thing she seems to care about, is whether or not he has decided to like follow her advice and read some classic books. And he doesn't even actually do it. He reads comics.
Right.
Instead.
No way does it have that detail, by the way. No way does it have a level of detail that she's asking.
No, at the very end, yeah, I know. And then he segues right after she says, it's over, it's not going to happen, I'm going to be married like next week or something. He pushes into her saying, no, I'm not going to accept that, until they kiss and they end up sleeping together. And it results in what is the movie, and again, listeners, we do this all the time. I'm not necessarily talking about my own moral beliefs, although my moral beliefs definitely play into this. I'm talking about what the movie is trying to sell me as being good. The movie sells us this as a beautiful moment of her realizing that she wants to be with him. She shows him there's no ring on her finger, that she came to watch him play. There is nothing in this film that I see that leads me to believe she would make that choice. And it is a very, very bad precedent to promote, that because there's nothing that we see about her fiance, in my opinion, that is, it's not like, oh, hey, this guy's beating me and now I have an out because I have learned that this is a bad person. He seems like a fine guy. Like, you just screwed him over, and She admonishes Jake Taylor in that moment right before they have sex. She admonishes him and scolds him once again, the second time in the film, for cheating on her. Specifically calls him out and says, but you did this. And he's like, oh yeah, but I'm past that now. I'm growing. And then proceeds to cheat on her fiance with him. And I will never get over that in film, Patrick, when a character yells at somebody about cheating, having been cheated on, and then proceeds to cheat themselves. And it's no big deal because it's the moment the movie wants us to celebrate. So anyway, I knew I was going to rant about this. It just really, really bothered me. And it knocked the movie down a notch.
I don't disagree. And I think that 2024 writing brain says you could do Jake Taylor's character without Rene Russo. I will say 1989 me would be like, I'm in for Rene Russo because she's fantastic. I love her in pretty much everything that I've seen her in. She's just, I adore her. And I fell in love with her with In the Line of Fire, and it made me mad that she was into Clint Eastwood. Like, you don't need that guy. You need a younger guy. Anyway. And so again, the younger me is like, great romance, but you're absolutely right. It slows the story down to a point where Jake doesn't need her. He doesn't have to need her to validate his ability to be a baseball player that can have what he says, quote unquote, one more day in the sun. Like, when he is toasting, here's to one more day. And for us old guys, you know, one more shot. If you didn't have his subplot with her, with Lynn, his bunt and everything leading up to that through a montage would have been completely fine. Because at some point, in fact, I think I remember reading there were more scenes with him and her. Like, there was an alternate ending or a scene where it was focused more on him and her. And the director actually said, we pulled those scenes because we didn't want it to become him and her centric. We didn't want it to be their story. And I'm like, absolutely not. I totally agree with that. But I would say, pull it back even further. Don't give him a love interest. You know, his story is that he is past his prime and he has one more chance to do something great. And he does. He doesn't need to look into the stands at a woman who he has coerced into cheating on her fiance with. As amazing as Rene Russo is, and I would say I champion being with Rene Russo, but I do not champion because it cheapens his character. Not that he needs to be some noble baseball player, but his performance on the field as it relates to the team makes him a character to root for. Like, I wanted to root for Jake Taylor, not because he was in this relationship with Lynn, but because he had this one last shot to do it. And that whole sequence where he bunts and it's all in slow motion and he's running down and he trips over the bag and you see him crash into his knee, his bum knee. I was like, it's done.
He gives it his all. You want to look up to him. But then, boom, we cut to Rene Russo and I'm like, you're a piece of crap. I can't look up to you now.
Yeah. But from just tonally speaking, it definitely slows the movie down. And you're right. That whole scene where he runs into her at her fiance's house and he's sitting there like basically becoming like stepping in, like, I'm here and I'm not leaving, metaphorically speaking. And says, you know, what are you doing after baseball? He's like, well, I'm going to, you know, move to Hawaii, have a couple of kids who grow up to be Olympic athletes. In what event? And he goes, you know, the 200-meter individual medley. Isn't that what you did, Lynn? You know, and it just makes me shake my head because I'm like, Jake, I guess I could say you're better than that, but you're really not, because apparently she's your kryptonite. And if you, you know, I guess having her and, you know, deflowering her while she's with somebody else allows you to be a better baseball player. That's kind of the message that's sort of being sent here. And it's frustrating.
Yeah, the message is what women complain about all the time, which is it is all about the man and the man who has done horrible things to the woman who has not deserved it nor retaliated. And it's all about him. It's about his feelings, about him doing all of these things to hurt her, but then getting a pass because now he wants to do things the right way. Now he wants to be in a relationship. So therefore, she should succumb to his timing and his desires. And the rest of her life, you know, be damned, she needs to come back and do it now because now he's ready. And that just, I guess having a daughter that's in, like, you know, old enough to be with people is just like, it's that.
I mean, if you were going to keep this subplot there. What I think would be fantastic is if he looked up, let's say he bought her a ticket, say, hey, come out, it's the last game. I may not be playing this time next year. It's my, you know, last shot or whatever. He gets a ticket, he knows where it is, and he looks up and that seat's empty. And then it cuts back to him and he's like, and he shakes it, he kind of nods his head and he says, okay. And then he's kind of, and he gets, you know, Ricky comes around, hugs him, and he's like, okay, I get it. I can't have everything, but I can have this moment. Like, that would have been pretty cool because it would have validated what he was doing on the field. And it would have given her agency of like, I didn't need to do that. Look, she had already established herself as a respectable, like, not like, I don't call her a librarian. She's a curator, I think, for this big library. Mm-hmm. And because he keeps dismissing, like, what is this? What is this?
Yeah, you know, fun we were of it hot the whole for time. Each other.
Yeah, it's incredibly dismissive.
So discondescending.
And it's just, I would love for her because I was like, Renee, you're better than that. You're better than this, right? Even if she had not been with this guy, like, don't even put this fiance in there. Like, that would have made him at least a little bit more respectable because he wasn't putting her in a position to cheat. And so, at the very least, it took so much attention away from, I think, what people were coming to the movie for, and it became more eye candy of like, oh, I'm glad Tom Berenger got the girl.
Yeah.
No, I'm not really. I mean, it was just, eh, whatever, right?
Yeah. Or just don't have the actual cheating happen. Have sure. him leave the house that night when she says, I'm going to get married, and then have her show up in the stands after the wedding. She makes it back to watch the game because she's his friend, not because she's going to be with him, but because she still cares right. about it. I just, you know, I think, but again, you're right. Like that, I'm reading this from an evolved 2024 cultural mindset of storytelling. And that was not the norm. This is very much the norm for the time period.
You're right. And I think that what we like about this movie, the comedic elements, it would have been tonally off. Oh, yeah. To have the 2024
version. Those wouldn't
have necessarily
worked either. Yeah.
No, because you know, we get the what you would call slapstick type of stuff and the Bob Uecker lines. They would not, cultural appropriation aside, you wouldn't have that same kind of slapsticky comedy script there because it wouldn't have felt like this was, like, this didn't work. I mean, it doesn't necessarily work for us for different reasons, but I think even if you had elevated it to that point, it would have felt more dramatic than it needed to be, as opposed to being like a feel good, let's root for this team. We're with them. We've been with these guys throughout this entire season, and we want them to win this game that gets them to the playoffs. So I don't know that it would necessarily jive with the comedy that we really enjoy in this 1989 version. So I would be willing to get rid of it completely for the sake of keeping the comedic parts of this movie that make it so much fun to watch. All right. Well, a movie like this, because I would call it a comedy first. I mean, it's not an action movie, obviously, or a drama. I think that it rests its laurels on the lines. We're not going to get into a quote fest, but are there any kind of a couple of them that stand out to you? Like, this is the ones that I remember even as a kid, or ones that always come up for you that you find as your favorites?
Well, yes, Patrick, of course. I think that there's a great line in the beginning. This is not really a comedic line, but just at the very first game, they're getting excited. And I believe it's the manager who says, relax, kid. He's talking to Vaughn. He says, relax, kid. There's 162 more of these coming up, right? And I was just like, oh, that's right. Baseball is so freaking long.
It's the longest,
most painful sport.
Yeah.
I have some favorite moments. I think the American Express ad at the end is just laugh out loud hilarious. Everybody is in on it, all the characters. It's even more funny now with Dennis Haysbert being the spokesperson for Allstate all these years. And with Willie Mays Hayes, you know, sliding in, doing the splits at the very end, saying, don't steal home without it, holding up.
Yeah.
It's comedy gold. The whole bit.
Yeah.
I could watch on repeat. It's the kind of thing you would send me a YouTube video of in the middle of a week, just randomly. I love that.
I may do that.
Yeah. I loved Serrano when he finally exercises the demons, when he says, F you, Jobu. I'm doing this for me.
This myself.
And then I do this myself. And then he runs around the bases pumping the bat in the air, yes. like holding the bat. Like, that doesn't happen. That just does not happen. It probably wouldn't be allowed. They'd probably, like, I don't know, penalize you or something. I don't know what baseball would do, but they would do something. Something to get the fun out of the game. But that was really fun. And then just, I think, of course, it's the whole ending, right? It's the whole moment of Vaughn being called upon from the pen. Like you said at the start of the podcast, neither one of us remembered that Rick Vaughn was a starting pitcher for 9/10 of this film. I and I actually looked some things up, and relief pitchers having walkout songs like that, the history of it goes back to like 1972, in some cases, maybe a little before that it's been mentioned. But when it really became a cultural thing was around the time of this movie. And it's after this movie that the most memorable ones have occurred, right? We have like an Edwin Diaz who comes out to his very memorable song, and you've got bands in the stands, like with horns playing it. You've got your, I believe, was it, who's your guy? Was it Rocker? That came out to Thunderstruck or something?
Yeah, I can't remember. I mean, and then he played for the Braves, but that dude was...
Yeah, that's what I mean.
He was a racist, man. I don't really want to quit.
Okay, well, the Braves player...
yes.
that used to come out to, like, Thunderstruck in this very similar way, and it's become a thing, right? Where it used to be just more batters, but relief pitchers also have that. And I just... That moment, I can't believe how... Like, I got kind of teary. Like, I realize, like, every time I watch a baseball movie, Patrick, something happens in it where I'm like, oh, I love this game. I hate that it's 162 games long in a season because it wears me down every year. But there's always something that happens in these games or in these movies about this specific sport that I'm just like, man. And to have the entire stadium. And I love that they don't just do the hook to the song and then move on. It's a pretty long scene, and they sing most of the song, and it cuts back and forth. And man, it gets me amped up, right? I'm like excited. I love that moment.
Well, there's an organicness to that, because I think I remember reading that Charlie Sheen, they filmed that several times, you know, took multiple takes, and they had, what, 5,000-10,000 people in the stands, which you can tell that it was filmed during the hottest part of the summer, because while the baseball players were all in like fall type paraphernalia, like the long sleeves. You can see people in like short sleeve shirts and shorts, and like people would not be in Cleveland in that kind of attire. But you had people that were screaming and singing with it. And Charlie Sheen has gone on record saying, man, it felt so good. Like it was one of his favorite moments in being in movies is to have that, because there's something magical. And that exclamation pointed with him getting ready to strike out, what's his name? Haywood, I think is what his name was, but how he, not Haywood, it's,
Bert,
whoever it was.
Somebody. Yeah. He's whatever, like a triple crown winner with a porn stash for the Yankees. Classic 80s baseball player.
But, anyway, but the way he gets himself amped up, the shot is from him from the back at the back of the bump. And he slams his glove into the ball and turns around like he's getting ready to fight somebody. I love that shot. It's so great because it's like he's locked in. Like, clear the mechanism, you know, from like for the love of the game. He's loaded. And then in three pitches, amplifying it up 2 miles an hour, 97, 99, 101. Even though today you've got pitchers that are doing that on the regular, there's something great about the fact that we find magic in the fact that pitchers get faster as the game goes on, especially starters. And that reminded me that, yeah, at the time he should be able to hit 98, 99 because he's fresh and he's a starter. So he's used to throwing that. And so I love that scene. I think that something that's captured really well is the excitement of fans at the beginning of a season. I mean, you say this every year. You're like, when you win your first game, if it's 1-0, it's like undefeated, 1,000. We're batting 1,000 right now. You know, we're undefeated until they lose that first game and then the second game or whatever. And then you realize that the law of large numbers says that eventually you're going to, I think it was, I want to say it was, I can't remember who it was on the West Wing that said, you know, in the game of baseball, you'll win 60 games, you'll lose 60 games. It's what you do with the other 60 that matter, because, or every team's going to win 60 and lose 60. It's what you do with the other 60. And I think that every team's fan, whether you're a Cub fan, a Braves fan, a Mariners fan, the beginning of the season excites you. And I think that it's so cool to see that sort of usurped a little bit by this opening montage of a slow burn. Hey, the season's starting. And then we get introduced to Rachel Phelps, who's just taken over the team. And the comedy just starts so subtly where she gives the, here's the players we're going to invite to camp. And you pointed this out to me. One guy said, this guy's here is dead. And she's like, cross him off then. Like, it's just so matter of fact. Like, we're just trying to get people to come out to camp.
Did you think about the fact that this is essentially inspiration for Ted Lasso? It is yes. Also about a female, a wife mm-hmm. of a team owner who... He doesn't die. Rupert doesn't die in Ted Lasso, at least not yet. but she gets control of the team, and her plan is to get back at him, essentially, or get rid of it, and to kind of take it over and revamp it and make it up in her own image. But she doesn't. But to do so, in both cases, they want to tank. They want to tank the value, essentially, mm-hmm. of it in order yeah, to 100%. Do the thing they want to do. I was like, oh my gosh, it's Rebecca.
Only yeah, first the pilot episode of Ted Lasso, I was redeemable. Like, this is my. Yeah, this is Major League. When I watched that pilot episode, I was like, this is Major League. And I'm glad that it didn't turn into Major League in terms of the plot, because it made the first season so much more magical by the time we get to the end of it. And if you want to hear my thoughts, you can hear that on an original series. Anyway, but yeah, I think Serrano's home run is great because of the fact that he's carrying that bat. I don't think there's anything illegal about doing it. But it makes sense. You know, you blast a home run, I'm going to carry my bat. I'm not dropping that thing. I want to carry the thing that I use to slug that ball out of the park. And while I don't think there was enough baseball per se, because everything was sort of lumped into that montage and then to the ending, I go back to the spring training. That's where it felt the most organic to me, because you see everybody sort of getting used to stuff. And it really felt like the actors that were out there, specifically Charlie Sheen, because I know he played baseball in high school, so he understood how to throw a ball. They all felt like they were genuine ball players. Like I think that there was some great care taken with depicting with somewhat accuracy, throwing a ball, swinging a bat. Like I don't know that there were, I think Serrano's was, I don't know. I think his was a little questionable for me, but it was still a great, great swing.
The only one that stood out to me was, I think it was in the final game, and there is a short hopper that Dorn fields on a bounce at shortstop. And the way that he catches the ball and then mm-hmm. throws it just is very unathletic. I mean, it's very clearly sure. an unathletic play. Yeah. But there's no way there's like a zip on the ball. But I mean, but I agree with you for the most part. They did okay with it. And I think it was easier to get by because, I mean, they're not supposed to be, we're not supposed to think of them as elite in the field or in anything, right? Like there's supposed to be that comedic element and it relaxes us. And so we don't nitpick those things.
Yeah. I also think that for most people who watch this movie, having Bob Uecker as Harry Doyle, the announcer, made perfect sense because, of course, he has, I think he's since retired, but he was the long time voice of the Milwaukee Brewers. Coincidentally, where they filmed most of the baseball in Brewers Stadium for this first entry. But I love that it felt like he was just being Bob Uecker and that he added those Indian mannerisms and how he interacted with his color guy. You know, they don't call him the best color guy in the business for nothing, where he's like, he says, you excited? Yep. You know, just very like he knows how to carry.
I like room. The one where he's like, the crowd goes wild. And the color guy's like, starts making all these different crowd sounds. Yeah.
And at one point, I think he says, and the Indians have had one hit. One hit, that's all we have, is one stupid hit. He doesn't say that, but the guy's like, you can't say that on the air. Who cares? Nobody's listening anyway. Like I feel like Bob Uecker's like, this is the stuff I would want to say when my team is in the slump or when I'm not having a good day. Like, these are the things that I'm being given permission to say, quote, on the air. But I think he adds a level of authenticity to this because of the fact that he is a radio broadcaster. Like, you wouldn't be able to get Vin Scully to do this. But the fact that Bob Uecker's an actor He was on Mr. Belvedere. Like, he has that sort of crossover type thing. And I think it was just a great choice to bring him in as the announcer for the Indians. All right. Any final thoughts before we wrap up, Aaron?
No, I haven't seen the sequel. Have you seen this? There's more than one. Have you seen
There's
them?
Actually three. There's three
total.
Oh,
that sounds bad. That sounds like it. That's not a good sign.
No. So I will say the second one's clearly a departure. Well, the second one is a drop off. Wesley Snipes doesn't return. So there's Omar Epps plays his character, Willie Mays Hayes. It actually gets a PG rating, so it's toned down quite a bit. I have grown to like Major League 3 Back to the Minors because it's very distantly connected to the franchise. Like, it's not the Indians. It's, I mean, Charlie Sheen, of course, isn't in it. Neither are really anybody, but Dennis Haysbert as Pedro Serrano, he's in all three. But Chelsea Ross, who's a longtime actor in a lot of baseball movies, he played Eddie Harris. He's not in it either. But it's got Scott Bakula in it, which makes me happy. I like Scott Bakula a lot. And so as long as I think of it not necessarily connected directly to the franchise, it's a fun kind of it's kind of got a, I don't know, maybe a more of a comedic thing. It's less dramatic and then more toned down. So I recommend it as a fun watch. It's definitely a personal favorite. But yeah, the second and third are significant departures from the first. Like, the first ones really can't be touched. So I recommend, but don't recommend. Like, if you want to keep the continuity going, no. But if you want to just enjoy these independently, absolutely go for it.
Cool. Yeah. Well, so. it was a good kickoff for the start of SEC play for us coming up next week for our college baseball teams and the end of spring. We're in the middle, I guess, of spring training right now. So
yeah. Do our teams square off this next weekend? I think we start with you guys.
No, I hope
it's the second.
No way.
See, the first or second series that we have.
Like a top three battle in the first SEC series.
It'll be the first or second weekend of SEC play because we have a gauntlet.
Every series is against a top 10 team, it feels like.
That's true.
It's insane. True. Our whole division is like in the top 15, I think. It's at Mississippi State, but like, yeah, it's wild.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. I think we play you second or third series or something like that. It's pretty close, but anyway. We might be friends by the time we finish off Feel and Film. We might not. We'll just see how this goes.
Yeah, hopefully it's not right before the final, or it's not the
we may have
of
to,
the final
we
episode.
We have to postpone the final episode to clear our heads if it's whatever the outcome is. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the conversation like we have. That'll do it for us. We'll talk soon.